Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach.
By becoming NCARB certified, like I did, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses.
Learn more at ncarb.org.
Hola, everyone, and welcome to another mini-sode of She Builds Charrettes. I'm Nerjeri Rivas, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jessica Rogers.
Hello, hello. Yes, it's just the two of us for this special charrette. And a reminder, these charrettes are just bonus episodes, different from our typical format, but still all of the fun.
You might be surprised to see a new episode on a Thursday. That's kind of strange. Right now, we're on a break, but during our regular season, we usually release episodes on Tuesdays. The reason we are releasing an episode today, Thursday, June 26, 2025, is because it's my birthday! Anyone that knows me knows I get very excited about my birthday and basically make it a June-long celebration.
Yeah, that's right. So listeners, this is your excuse to grab yourself a piece of cake or some chocolate, an extra cup of coffee in honor of the birthday girl. You have permission.
Today I wanted to celebrate with y'all by sharing excerpts from an interview I read between Olivia de Oliveira and Lina Bobardi in the International Architecture Review magazine, Nexus 2G, Lina Bobardi Built Work, number 2324, in 2022, pages 230 to 255. That's like the first time I read a bibliography.
Well, gotta share our sources.
That's right. The 2.5-hour interview was transcribed in the magazine, and that was like a lot.
Yeah.
I did my best to edit out parts of it to keep this episode under an hour. I don't know if we're going to make it.
Yeah, so you gave us the synopsis during those two-part episodes, and now we're going to give you another little tidbit of it. But we mostly removed information that was already covered on our previous Lina episodes.
Yes, and I asked Jessica to join me to play the part of Olivia while I live my dream and pretend I'm Lina Bobardi.
Another birthday wish come true.
For a little context, just so people know why we're doing this, it's really special for me to do this with Jessica because we were partners on a studio semester project when we both learned about Lina Bobardi.
Ah, yes. Yes, Nojiri, we were in Italy and we were designing the new terminal for a high-speed train in Florence, part of our studio class.
We called our project the Low Line. And beyond being a train terminal, it was about connecting people with their context and exploring different ways people could interact with their space.
Yes. And our studio professor, shout out to Daniel De Riva, he recommended that we look up Lina Bobardi and study her projects and her approach to architecture.
And thus, my love for Lina Bobardi began. And I know Jessica's too.
Yes.
To this day, she's one of my favorite architects. The way she thought about space and architecture and how she materialized those ideas is absolutely everything to me.
Yes. And I mentioned it earlier. She was a two-parter, right?
Yeah.
Because we didn't do three parts.
No. Not yet. Coming soon. Okay. Yeah, I wrote a story that was so long, we had to break it in two. If you haven't heard episodes 37 and 38 of She Builds podcast, I strongly recommend that you do.
Yes. It'll give good context of where we are in this time in Lina's life.
Yes.
All right. So Should we get this party started, Lena?
Yes! Well, let's do it. Here begins the transcript of an interview Olivia de Oliveira had with Lena Bobardi on September 27th, 1991. Listeners, please keep in mind, parts have been edited for time.
I'd like to start in Italy. You finished your training in 1940 in the faculty in Rome?
Yes, I graduated in 1940 in Rome. Well, I was born there, in Rome no less. Everything was in ruins. As a kid, I was afraid of all the beauty in Rome and said to myself, why is everything in ruins? There must be an explanation. When I arrived in Rio de Janeiro, I met some amazing people. Oscar Niemeyer, Lucio Costa, Candido Portinari, a group of intelligent and formidable young people. And on top of that, there were no ruins in Rio. Everything was blue, very nice. What a marvel. We were coming out of the war, and we were youngsters participating in the resistance. Afterwards, we saw how everything fell apart. I liked Brazil a lot, although Sao Paulo, less so. In Italy, those of us who were working with Elio Vittorini, we formed a resistance based on the underground Communist Party. Elio Vittorini was a writer who died young, an important figure in the party. On arriving in Brazil, he gave orders for them to say, Lena, I envy you. You had the courage and you left all that behind. At the time, it seemed to me that Brazil was a country where you were able to do things, and I've done them.
Which architects participated in this movement in Italy with you?
There weren't many. Piero Bottoni, Ludovico Belgiojoso. The most modern and best-known architects were all leftists.
You studied in La Sapienza in Rome?
Yes, I studied at the College of Advanced Architecture, the old architecture faculty that's now on the university campus. I don't like it. Ours was very nice. It was in Villa Borghese.
You were a student of Marcello Piacentini's.
Yes, Piacentini was both professor and dean. A very intelligent guy who started out well, very young, winning one of the top prizes in the 1912 exhibition with a major project, but also from a very famous and rich family. At a certain moment, I started working because people worked while they were studying. I drew very well. I was working, I made drawings and did a competition for Piacentini, who won. I also did drawings for other students.
Pietro Maria Bardi was a very important figure as an art critic in Italy. He participated in the 4th CIAM alongside the Patris, along with Le Corbusier and various Italian architects belonging to the movement.
He was important, a very famous journalist. He was the one who supported the rationalist movement in Italy, its most important figure.
How long had you known him?
From very small. As I drew and painted extremely well as a girl, my parents thought I ought to go to university, but leaning towards the arts. So I did the art course at the liceo, the high school. I had a good training. My father was an engineer, but he painted and drew marvelously. So I studied a lot with my father, and it's to him I owe my training in an analytical drawing style. I chose the liceo art course rather than the science or classical one, like my sister did, because that way you had direct access to the architecture faculty and a certain preparation. They gave classes in technical drawing, for instance, which schools didn't. In Italy, there was no entrance exam. I don't know about now. I don't think there is either. If you had the liceo art diploma, the university was free for everybody. A lot of students ran out of steam after the first year because we had the 2-year mathematics course. After the mathematics biennale, you needed to pass an exam to get onto the practical bit. 3 years of project design. Since the 2-year course had the same program as the engineering faculty, except for highway engineers. Aside from the engineering specialty, the program was identical. I did it and it no longer exists, which is a mistake. 2 years. It was very hard and a lot of people gave up. Now it's more like here in Brazil. Afterwards, the training shifted towards decoration and became a complete mess. But I did 2 years of math and the professors were the same as those in the Faculty of Engineering.
The Polytechnic.
No, the Polytechnic was in Milan. It was the engineering faculty. I had some strict academic teachers. The Prospettiva professor was a scientist and incredible. Nobody got more than 6 or 7. The highest was a 7. And I got it because he liked me a lot. And I already knew about such things. Details I'd learned with my father.
And it was there that you met Professor Pietro Maria Bardi.
No, I knew him by name because he was famous. He was completely mad. He was very young, 28 or 29, and responsible for the Gallery of Rome. I was in the art liceo, and my classmates tried to mount an exhibition in Bardi's gallery, a municipal gallery in Via Veneto that he ran brilliantly, with tremendous flair. It was practically his. One classmate was the son of an academic, His Excellency Orestano, a friend of Mussolini's. Mussolini sent a stiff note to Pietro at the gallery, which depended on the government, saying, "Si faccia l'esposizione, do the exhibition." And Pietro said, "I'm not doing it. It was something you just didn't do because His Excellency Orestano had links." Then Pietro said, "Let him exhibit then, but with easels not against the walls, but 70 to 80 centimeters in front to show I've got nothing to do with it. There, stuck right in the middle." That's the way it was done, and he never went. So I told Orestano's son, who was my classmate and who'd organized it all, "I'm doing nothing because the whole thing's a sham." He told me, "His Excellency Marinetti, the capo del futurismo, is to open the exhibition." I told him, "He's not going to like it. It's an absolute shambles." I remember Orestano presented his work, Project for a Macaroni Factory. It was a third-year project. Just imagine, what an idea. He made the building tutto green, spinach green, chiaro. So Marinetti opened the show and said, "Excellent, you've made a factory with actual spinach macaroni. It's green." Pietro was furious and took the whole lot down after 2 days. It was then that I met him. My classmates were all enthusiastic because they'd held an exhibition. I was the only girl among 30 male students, and they asked me why I hadn't exhibited. And I answered, because I didn't know how to make anything that could be exhibited. So there was Bardi, hopping mad. He forbade them to put things on the walls. And afterwards, Marinetti said Orestano's project was very good because it was the color of spinach macaroni. I said to Orestano, "Have you no shame? What is that?" Today, Pietro still has the same sort of genius, a genius which doesn't attract many people. There are a lot of folk who don't understand him, but he seems wonderful to me.
Okay, next. The interview discusses the time Lina lived in Milan and her time with Giuseppe Pagano and Gio Ponti. They also discuss her work that she began doing in magazine Domus. This is mentioned on episode 37. Lina then shares she had her firm for a while and how it was bombed during the war.
My studio was destroyed by the bombing in Milan in 1943. I lost a lot of things, including my diploma, which I had to ask for again. My mother wrote a letter to the minister, and afterwards they gave me a second copy. I lost drawings, objects.
Where did you have the studio?
In the Via Gesù, Via Monte Napoleone, an elegant location, very pretty. In one of those ancient buildings with fountains and a garden, it was all destroyed. They were splendid years of hope.
How long did those splendid years of hope last?
In 1945, the war finished and I left for Rome to create a weekly magazine. I edited Domus, and I went because I created a weekly that belonged to Domus. Next, I went to Garsanti, a big and very important publishing house, then as now. Next, I went to do a news feature, and seeing as Italy was occupied by the U.S. Fifth Army, I had to ask permission. I went to speak to the Americans. I told them what I wanted to do, and they gave me a document, a permit, to be able to pass among their troops and tanks. It was the week the war had ended, and I found myself right in the middle of the American army. It was terrifying. It was a miracle nothing happened. It wasn't a very cheering adventure. In 1946, we realized that our dream of a modern, free country was over. Free elections were held, and the Christian Democrats won. It was awful. And I said, I'm off.
Did you and Pietro suffer any type of persecution in Italy, such as occurred in the Spanish Civil War?
I've never been in prison. I've suffered persecution here in Brazil, but I've never been in prison because I'm like an insect. When I want to, I hide underground. I know how to disappear. I'm a past master at such things. I saw some horrible things, but nothing ever happened to me.
Did you get to build any architecture in Italy?
In Rome? No, there was nothing. Nobody was doing anything.
And in Milan?
No, I did the odd thing with Pier Luigi Nervi through Pietro in the Studio de Arte de Palma. I went to see Pietro for the magazine and did an interview with him because I knew his name. I was the editor of Tempo. I ran Gracia, on which I had 4 pages. Everybody was up in arms against me and reproached me with, "You write for a woman's paper." Gracia was important. One time, I received a letter which said, "Lena imitates a poor woman's voice." "What can I do? I've got a baby, but I don't have money for a cot or anything to make one with." I told her to take a small fruit crate. I did the obviously homemade design that way, with a quilt inside, a bedspread of remnants, something simple because she had nothing. Then I told her to put a little ruffle around it and to paint it. What enthusiasm there was! I received piles of letters. I mean, that was something social. Next, the architects, my colleagues, Franco Albini, even Giancarlo Palanti, a teacher of mine who'd finished studies 10 years before me, said, "Look what Lena's up to." To which I answered, "I've done popular things that were really good. You don't know the half of it." So Castiglioni, who belonged to a group of very fine and very bright architects, the best around the time in Italy, said, "You guys are wrong. Lena's done something we didn't know how to do because nobody's commissioned us to do it. She's doing something that's helped a lot of people. I did it because it was very hard. I had nothing. A bit of cloth. It was a huge success."
So why did you work as a professional journalist?
If not, what was I going to do?
A lack of options then.
I was a technical journalist, handling issues related to architecture and industrial design all the time. Industrial design wasn't called that way back then. The name came from the US and we adopted it. It was another hope we had and it no longer exists today. It failed. We thought we could save humanity with modern architecture and industrial design. It's proved impossible.
This was when you and Pietro left Italy.
I wanted to leave Italy, but I didn't want to get married to anyone. I was fond of Pietro. And one time he said, "Look, you can't not get married because afterwards you go to a hotel and it's very disagreeable." He was right. Why make a hash of something? So we got married. One morning, we went to the Capitolio with 2 witnesses.
The Capitolio, how sweet. Wait, pause though. So did she get married just because it would be easier for her to get a hotel?
I think she got married so that they could travel together.
Yeah, without like, oh, you don't have a, you're an unwed woman or whatever.
Exactly.
So they met out of like convenience.
It sounds like a marriage of convenience, but mm-hmm. I mean, she loved him.
Okay, good.
I think that she was like ahead of her time and she was like, I didn't want to marry anybody.
Yeah.
But
just like for the ritual of marriage or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I understood.
Okay.
This is good.
Okay.
Because I know this interview gets like confusing because she's all over the place. So if you ever like, wait, let's talk about this. Let's do it.
Okay.
We got married in the Capitolio with a ring and all. We respect each other a lot. We've each had our freedom, and neither of us has poked their nose into the other's business. Do you know what I mean? On top of that, Pietro had work outside and was traveling a lot. We wrote every day. It was really lovely because when people write each other, more things get said than when they talk face to face. You get accustomed to talking. They were good times. Later, I thought, I need to do something. That was when we decided to acquire Brazilian nationality. Although Pietro had already acquired it a year before. But Pietro's never forgotten Italy. He remembers it even today. Me? No. I remember nothing. It doesn't interest me in the least. For me, there's only Brazil. Since it's a country I have a special affection for. A poor country, poor people, but very rich, marvelous. Somewhere you could do things. Politically, Brazil's situation is very dangerous, especially right now.
So you left Italy and came straight to Brazil?
No, we came a roundabout way. It's true, I knew the whole of Italy, but I'd never travel abroad. So Pietro said, right, we're going to do a big trip because you know nothing. He was enamored of Latin America. Way back in 1933, at the time of Terragni, he'd mount an exhibition in Buenos Aires, an exhibition about modern architecture that was a huge success. On the way back to Europe, he'd stopped off in Brazil and had liked it a lot, so he wanted to go back. We made travel plans to go to Quito and then to Mexico and then from there back to Italy, but it didn't work out that way. Pietro had a very intelligent Italian friend who'd been a journalist in Berlin and who was married to a German woman, a very interesting couple. They wrote saying they were expecting us, and so we arrived in Rio de Janeiro, where I had a friend. We saw some wonderful things and got all excited. I was dazzled by such great architecture. I'd never seen anything like it. It was an enormous success. We liked the place a lot and met the most interesting people the country had at the time. I said to Pietro, I'd really like to stay here a while longer. Then, Assis Chateaubriand invited Pietro to create a museum in Brazil. I thought it was fantastic, and I wanted to do a museum. And Chateaubriand, with his technique, an elegant sort of blackmail, everybody was afraid of him.
All right, so at this point of the interview, Lena digressed a little bit or a lot of bit and started talking about Chateaubriand's personality and how he asked Pietro and Lena to do a museum for his artwork, which eventually became Maspi. We share this story on episode 37 and 38 and also on the Shret, the Maspi site selection. So we actually kind of did three-parter. Okay, so she then talks about the construction. So now this is part four. Sorry. Okay, so she then talks about the construction of the museum. She worked alongside another architect, Professor J.C. Figueiredo Ferraz, who did the structural calculations. Now we're going back to Lena and her discussion or description of the structural calculations or the work of the Maspi.
They put up the bottom bit and the building work stopped. Only the Belvedere got finished, though the bottom part, not very well constructed. Ma, insomma, correct. Later, when Mayor Prestes Maia was elected in 1961, he called me and wanted to go on with the museum project. He thought a lot of Ferraz, and this resulted in the marvelous design for the huge beam. So we did the museum. I went through every little thing. The foundations of the pillars were located alongside the Avenida Paulista. They were very nice, webbed feet, that Ferraz calculated personally at the time when there were still weren't any computers. He did all the calculations in a cuaderno, a cuadretini, a notebook with squared paper, all by hand and pencil. Very handsome. Ferraz is extraordinary. But afterwards, I don't know what happened. He isn't doing anything. Something's up. I don't know what. So the building's work began. I don't really know what happened, but there was some sabotage. The four pillars started in the platform. They were up to the height of the Avenida Paulista, and the rebars had been left sticking out a meter above the ground, ready for being extended upwards. One morning, everything appeared sawn off flush with the ground.
The inset rebars?
Ferraz went crazy, like a wild animal. He called all the construction company people and chewed them out. They were guilty because there was a guard and none of it should have happened. We never really found out what did occur.
If you're an architect, a designer, a firm leader, or an entrepreneur trying to build something that actually lasts, there's a new podcast just for you. Gable Media is proud to introduce Frosty and Fired Up.
Let's just be honest about it. I mean, the most powerful weapon on the face of the planet is between our two ears. And when architecture can evoke that emotion positively to create spaces for people to come together, that's a very powerful thing.
Hosted by Miller Caldwell, CEO and principal in charge of Caldwell Architects, this podcast was created out of a simple belief. Architecture deserves better leadership, better culture, and a healthier profession.
The actions of every architect affect every other architect in some way. What I mean by that is if we are not focused
on maintaining the health of the profession.
Right. If we're not focused on those things and we're only focused on our internal needs, there's a greater ecosystem that we have to respect and we're responsible to.
Over the last decade, Miller has been on a personal journey, figuring out what it really means to lead, how discipline shapes outcomes, and why culture always matters more than strategy alone. Along the way, he realized these conversations shouldn't stay inside the walls of his firm.
You know, we all have our superpowers in what we do, and I would say one of my superpowers is probably business development. And the way I've become better at business development, I would say, is being intentional about connecting. When you're invited to do something, say yes.
Frosty and Fired Up shares honest conversations about the things architects don't always say out loud. Ownership, accountability, wellness, mindset, money, leadership, and the hard work behind meaningful design.
Unfortunately, architecture is a slow art. It takes a long time to produce. It takes many years to get good at it. His decisions are what take the longest time. It's not the drawing, usually.
You'll hear conversations with people who challenge and sharpen leadership, helping push the profession forward. This isn't about perfection. It's about getting better. One decision, one habit, one day at a time.
That ultimately is the process, right? I mean, focus on what's in front of you, what the priority is, and work your way through it. It is going to be hard because it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be hard because it means something.
Subscribe now at the link in the show notes. Frosty and Fired Up, now available wherever you get your podcasts.
The pillar I designed was 4 meters wide. Ferraz found it excessive and reduced it a bit to 3.5 meters, I think. I wasn't too keen because I preferred something broader. But faced with the difference in costs, I had to go along with him. Real architecture is a struggle. If the architect does a sketch, draws the building, he parts with it, and doesn't take the pains, it's not the same. On seeing the buildings I've constructed, I recall everything, down to the tiniest detail. Now, in the new city hall, the management team controlling the building work will be on site. The office will be there. I no longer have an office. I mount it inside the buildings. The engineers love this, and they all want to come to the office too and set up the engineering section with us. It's a big job. It's well paid, but not well paid enough because it involves a lot of time and responsibility. In reality, you construct the building yourself. If not, you don't get certain things.
How do you work now? What's your work team like?
I work with a few youngsters I'd had as students at the FAU. They completed their studies and now they're with me. Then there's Professor Ferraz and all the engineers from his office, a very big and important one. I consider it important that everybody contributes. Yesterday, I didn't go to work. I didn't feel well because I've broken a leg. I slipped over and broke it. Next, I had 2 heart attacks. I almost died. Now the leg's fine, although extremely thin. These last 3 days, I can move everything. I even say to myself, wow, I've ended up with the legs of a 20-year-old. Now I show my legs to everybody. I have a problem with the circulation of my extremities. When I mounted an exhibition, for instance, I was 15 or 20 days on my feet, walking around or drawing. Our profession is no joke. I draw standing up without moving. I spend the whole night on my feet or days on end. It's hard, but there's nothing else for it.
Wow. Sorry. She's crazy. Sorry. I got the legs of a twin. And how casually she's like, oh, yeah, you know, I wasn't feeling well. I broke my leg. I had 2 heart attacks, she says casually.
All good.
All good. It gave me the legs of a 20-year-old. Okay. And then I wonder if that's what it meant. Like, because, like, you know, you see those photos of, like, how they did drafting back then of, like, they would do it by hand. But I just see them laying down and drawing. But I'm wondering if she did it not that way. She did it standing up. I guess.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Oh, man, I wish I could see photos of that. That sounds...
Imagine how long it took.
Yeah, geez. And they don't have anti-fatigue, like, pads that you would put under your feet. And she was probably wearing, like, a little bit of heel, because you know how those how the shoes were back then for women? Okay. To go back a bit. When you arrived in Brazil, you also ran the magazine Habitat here, right?
Yes. Pietro created it. He had the idea. He paid for all of it. And I ran it.
You ran it till...
No, I ran it at the beginning. Then I got tired of it. I rode with the editor, who was a German. What was his name? A well-mannered fellow. Very pleasant. But a real blockhead. It was impossible. He was interested in the business side. But this included, for instance, crappy advertisement. I didn't go along with that. Pietro also got bored. I only edited the first few issues. The first had a cover of mine, a very nice one. Then it turned into a real mess. Klein took it over because Pietro left, and me with him. It was finished.
Did you teach at the Universidad de Sao Paulo, the USP, USP, or at any other university?
I gave classes at the FAU.
Because I've seen a thesis written by you in 1957 for the Theory of Architecture professorship. A slim volume.
Yes, Theory of Architecture.
Okay. Did you give classes at that time? I mean, was it before leaving for Salvador or during the Salvador period?
Before. I wanted to participate in the public competition for the Theory of Architecture professorship at the FAU. But they didn't want me there because I was a leftist, a tough cookie. And at the time, the professors were from engineering. Good teachers, but it was a tragedy. The students kicked up a huge fuss. There was a competition and they didn't let me put my name down. I don't know why. So I asked them to send me all my degree documents legalized in Europe via the embassy. And I immediately sent a writ. The day the final inscription date came around, a legal official arrived from Rio de Janeiro, which was the capital at the time, with an order to put me on the list with the writ. And do you know what happened? They suspended the competition. It's not been convoked even now. I roared with laughter and said, I'm leaving Sao Paulo, and decided to go to Salvador straight away.
And in Salvador, did you get to teach at the university in the theater or architecture faculty?
I gave a course on the theory of architecture at the faculty in Salvador, which is federal, not regional. At the time, it was a brilliant faculty. Now, I don't know. Professor Reboaus was there and he let me do 3 months teaching. He attended too. He's a good friend of mine and I like him a lot.
How long did you stay in Bahia?
I was invited in 1958 by the Universidad Federal de Bahia to give a course. The students were very enthusiastic. I taught the 5th years, but all the years came. It was really nice. The students were very bright. There was dialogue, debate, and so on. It was a very nice time when Salvador was in the front line in Brazil. As a university, it was terrific. It had a wonderful theater school, the music school, the dance one with Yanka, a very free school, all very nice. Afterwards, zilch. It all ended.
I remember that one of the first things that grabbed my attention in architecture was the Chame House in Salvador.
But they knocked it down.
And it was the first time I got really angry about the disappearance of a work of architecture because I had a woman friend who lived opposite the house.
Yes, I had a big row with the owners. I was friends with Feloni Matos, a very intelligent doctor and brother-in-law of the owner of the house, who was extremely reactionary. It was this doctor friend who insisted I go to Salvador. If not, I wouldn't have gone. There was nothing there. I went to Salvador to look at the site and talk to the person who was going to build the house. The doctor was a big friend of ours. He didn't want to charge us. A young and intelligent person. They got excited about the house. The plot was tiny, and at the time, it didn't have anything around it. Afterwards, they built a lot of tilings mistakenly. I don't have a single photo of when I did the house because it was when I had to leave in a hurry. I didn't see it finished, and I don't even know what they did. The design was very nice because it was in the middle of the plot. The family was a big one. They had kids. The house was small, and the plot of land was small too, 500 meters square. But it seemed big, and it had a garden that entered the house. The windows didn't have frames. The window panes were flush instead. It was very nice.
And why did you have to leave Salvador in a hurry?
Because of all that fuss in 1964 broke out, and in Salvador, everything was extremely reactionary. People started being afraid of us, and I was already marked by the Cosa Cosi as being a leftist. I was here in Sao Paulo, and I received a telegram from my secretary, who was the brother-in-law of the sculptor Mario Cravo, saying, Madalena, a mongrel puppy I'd found in the street and had given food to there, is sick. It's best you come until she gets better. And I said to myself, something bad's happened there and I can't go back. The puppy didn't die. Afterwards, she got better. That's how it was. I waited until the coup. It wasn't a coup. It was something else entirely. But in Bahia, the Navy was awful, and they instigated proceedings against me there. I hid, disappeared. So I went back in June with the abolition of the Institutional Act, but I realized that there was nothing left. They'd done away with everything, and it never did get put back ever. It was all done with.
Okay, pause.
That was like a secret message.
Yes. Okay. So that's what it was. So the secretary was basically going to sell her out.
You think?
Well, it was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because she was like, come back. Or he, come back. The dog is sick.
Yeah. Shameful. Oh.
Or the way I read it was like that was his way of telling him not to come. But I think your way makes a little more sense. Who knows?
Maybe the secretary wasn't a bad person. Maybe it was like the government or whoever that was like force the secretary, like, you write this message and you get her here. But oh my God, what a troubling time.
I know.
I just keep thinking about Lena. I'm an insect. I sneak my way. This is her sneaking.
She disappears.
Oh, God. And I think in the episode, I don't know if we said it, but we referred to her. She's an insect. What kind of insect? She's a cockroach. She never dies. I don't know. I remember that conversation.
Yes. I was listening to it yesterday. I was like, oh, this is what we said.
Jeez. But now we know why, because she was shifty like that. Okay, now we're back. Today, after 3 years away from Brazil, I visited Salvador again, the Pelourinho with the design for the Benin house and the whole rehabilitation plan. UNESCO had made an inventory of the Pelourinho, and I had a lot of expectations, high hopes as to the Pelourinho. I don't know how long it's been since you were in Salvador, but it's all falling into rack and ruin. It's a great pity because the historic center of Salvador is beautiful and you can't even set foot there anymore.
I only did the Ladeira de Misericordia. The Pelourinho was something Vivaldo Costa Lima did years ago. He painted it pink and sky blue, but the Pelourinho was gray and white before. I hope we're saying it right. Listeners, if we've mispronounced this, we're very sorry.
So the project's over?
Sure, I finished it, but it wasn't unveiled because I considered it essential that the residents went on living there, and not some tourists from Sao Paulo or other foreigners, that they didn't transform the place, as it happens in Italy or in France. A place that isn't especially pretty because of its architecture, but because of its popular appeal. At the time, they didn't have the nerve to do what I said, because they were living above, and below they had a small jewelry business. Necklaces, clothes, handmade furniture for sale, that kind of thing. That it would go on being something decent and ordered, private. They didn't do it.
You've always had the possibility, I don't know if due to chance or coincidence, of undertaking rehabilitation projects.
In the architecture faculty in Italy, we taught rehabilitation and the surveying of plans. In the first year, they surveyed plans of ancient buildings that were important or interesting for some reason. Later in the second year, we taught restoration, restauro they call it, which isn't rehabilitation. With all its theories from the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th centuries, something important.
I imagined it was an Italian legacy or something, because in Brazil, it's very difficult. Here, the old gets destroyed, even if it's worth keeping, in order to put up something new in its place. It's absolutely normal, and you are one of the few architects who's done it. I don't know if the rehabilitation scheme comes from you or not on many occasions.
Yes, that's the way it is. But I always make the plea to keep something old and afterwards to have something modern come out of it. Now, for instance, I'm doing the new city hall in Sao Paulo, which is currently in the Palacio das Indústrias, a building with a plan from the end of the last century, built at the beginning of this, more or less between 1920 and 1928. Next, at one side is the new city hall, all in reinforced concrete, which has nothing to do with the old one. One has to know about city planning in order not to destroy things with something disproportionate, turbid, something that, historically speaking, has to be preserved. This is an important theory. My teacher in Rome, Gustavo Giovannoni, was practically the finest historian and technical expert on this subject. Afterwards came the Venice Charter in 1965. But I'd studied the issue from the first year at the university and gone on pursuing it because I see no difference between the historical and the modern aspect.
A curie. Okay, question. How do you see the architect's relationship with the public authorities? You claim you don't like doing private houses and that you prefer working with the public authorities.
If someone comes and asks me what color the carpets or the curtains has to be, I say, no, senora. It's not worth the trouble.
It appears that Oscar Niemeyer and you are the two Brazilian representatives who work the most on public projects.
You don't make a lot that way. There are architects who do the project free because they receive a commission from the supplier of the materials, the provider of the furnishings, the decorator, the upholster, etc. They and they get rich that way. But this isn't the case with me or with Oscar.
You believe in the social importance of the architect. Is that why there's this insistence on working with the public authorities?
One does things that affect thousands and thousands of people. You can do an apartment block, something which is good, but it doesn't interest me, and I don't know how to do it. On finishing my studies, I designed the odd thing for important people, even a medium-sized house for Mondadori that then wasn't built because you couldn't build anything. But I've designed furniture because I did design. I also studied it at university. Design was on all the courses, apart from in the first year, which was introductory. From the third to the fifth year, it was an important subject.
Not long ago, I read the first article that appeared in the first issue of the magazine Habitat about the houses of Joao Villanova Artigas, an article of yours. It's very beautiful the way you describe Villanova Artigas' personality, saying that he doesn't like to appear as someone important, very ethical and poetic in his way of practicing architecture. While reading it, I made the parallel with your own way of thinking, even with the preliminary plan for his house, maybe.
I think that way, too.
And it seemed to me there was some kind of rapport with Villanova Artigas, and that's to say you knew Artigas?
I knew all the important architects, Oscar Niemeyer, Lucio Costa, Villanova Artigas.
Who would you say was outstanding in Brazilian architecture?
Well, I like Niemeyer a lot. I even wrote, if Juscelino Kubitschek hadn't built Brasilia, Brazil would still be a little South American republic. I like Villanova Artigas a lot too. They are good architects. Now, there isn't the same respect, the enthusiasm, the militancy, because it was militancy that architects had at the time. Niemeyer doesn't like to be alone. He's always accompanied by a bunch of people. He has a beautiful friendship with lots of friends. Oscar was here just 2 weeks ago, and we had lunch together in his very house because we were going to hold a debate in the museum, in the Institute of Brazilian Architects. I didn't feel well that day. I was annoyed. I realized I couldn't go because the debate would last a long time, and the next day I had to sign a formal contract at the government house for the building of the new city hall. And you have to be standing up all the time. The mayor reached an agreement with the governor of Sao Paulo, so the protocol is that everybody would be standing apart from two people, those two. As I know what this means, I said, what am I going to do? I couldn't be much time on my feet. Now I'm better. But imagine 2 weeks ago. My relationship with the public authorities is in Recife or in Rio de Janeiro. I worked in the Lacerda era, with all that that entailed. And I didn't agree politically with Lacerda. When he called me, I said, Governor, you know I am not on your side. To which he replied, I know, but I need you. He wanted to do something really good with Lage Park, but it wasn't possible because they didn't let him. He died still young from the blow. He was a very intelligent person. I never really liked him. But he wasn't petty-minded. He was very noble as a figure. I mean, but he had some cranky ideas. At the beginning, he was very communist, very. His father was a communist, a leftist. After he moved to the right, I don't know what happened. He was very intelligent, and I never had any misunderstanding with him. Nobody was allowed to tell me no to something like that.
I'd like to know if there's some special building, some project you'd like to do.
I like doing what I have to do. The new city hall in Sao Paulo, for instance.
A future project, something you once thought of doing, and...
That's never happened to me. When I passed by the Trianon and saw the design for the public toilets, I said, this is where I build the Sao Paulo Museum. And there it stands. I never yearned to do impossible things. At the time, I relied on blackmailing Ademar because he wanted to be a president of the republic.
Another quarry. Is there any reason in particular why your work has been published so little?
What do you mean I haven't been published? Abroad, loads of times.
No, here in Brazil. For example, I'm surprised there still isn't any book, a catalog about your work as a whole.
Oh, no. You too? There's Pietro's book. Pietro, Guedes, Marcelo, my friends, were wanting to do a book with my work. And I've said to them, he who doesn't build, does a book. I already have an oeuvre, and if they don't know about it, it's their problem. And that was the end of the interview. By the way, for people like me who didn't know what the meaning of oeuvre was, it means a substantial body of work constituting the life work of a writer, an artist, or a composer. So Lena was saying, like, I already have all this built work. If you don't know about it, that's your problem. I don't need a book.
But we do.
Well, Jessica, what did you think?
I loved it. I know that this is our fourth iteration, our fourth installment of discussing Lena's life. And I mean, I think originally we fell in love with her work way back when, over 12, 15 years ago when we got introduced to her. But now, like, as we learn more about her work and now hearing this beautiful interpretation of an interview of her describing her work and her life, I love her even more. I love hearing her tenacity, and I love how she, like, her resiliency is, like, out of this world. So it was great to hear that.
It is. And, you know, a lot of it was, like you said, I see it, I want it, I do it.
Yeah.
And I wonder if she ever had any insecurities at all, because it doesn't come out that way.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it's because she survived a war.
Yeah.
She's like, after this, everything else is gravy, you know?
Yeah. Or she's also, like, after every instance, right? Like, oh, if I would have went back to save my quote-unquote, you know, mongrel puppy, they would have captured me then. And then she, like, bypasses it, so she feels, like, invincible. Like, oh, yeah, I survived a war. I survived persecution. Yeah, that's right. I never went to prison, and I got to do all these things. I really enjoyed it. So I liked that we got to talk about her. I also liked to hear her, like, she did a lot, right? She taught, she wrote, she built. So I like seeing the connection between all three, or like all of those different areas in her life, and how they kind of integrated into everything, and how she kind of just, like, picked up things as they came along.
Yeah. To her, it was all the same.
Right.
Which is so interesting. Like, it gives you, it makes you think about all the things we could do with our profession.
Yeah.
It doesn't just have to be buildings and architecture with right. capital A, which she did. Mm-hmm. She also wrote. She also did furniture. Like, she did yeah. everything.
Which makes you wonder about the other ladies that we talk about, like, that do those things. Like, I wonder if that's how they felt about it, or that's how they came about all the things that they did, that they thought about it in the way that Lena did.
That makes sense. Yeah.
I also think it's really interesting, this, like, government, like, retaliation of, like, her, or, like, the powers that be, how they retaliated against the things that Lena did. Like, sawing off the rebar or the masking. Like, yo.
Well, we don't know if it was the government.
Allegedly.
We don't know.
Okay, yeah, allegedly. You gotta put that, I guess. But, like, WTF. Like, ooh, yeah. Now I understand why she's angry, though. She's petty. I would be too.
My favorite part was when they had a competition for the professor for theory.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to let her in. And then when they had to let her in, they canceled the competition.
Yeah, like, what the? Like, jeez. Oh, my gosh. People.
You know, there is... Okay, don't tempt me, but there's, like, a big chunk of the story that we didn't say today. We might be saying it next year for my birthday.
The fifth installment. It's just going to be a running thing. Like, we're going to find some other interview.
Oh, heck
yeah. We're
going to
read the book, or when they finally publish her oeuvre, and then we'll discuss that.
We're never going to stop.
Never. Lena Fair for life.
Yeah. Well, Jessica, thank you so much. I don't even know how much time we're at right now. Do you see the time?
But it's okay. It's your birthday. We're going to celebrate. Do like Lena. Do what you want.
Okay. Listeners, thank you so much.
Well, I really enjoyed this charrette. Hope all of you out there listening enjoyed it too. Please let us know what topics that you would like us to have a charrette on, and you might hear a future episode based on your suggestion.
Before we say goodbye, we want to say thank you to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical advisor, and most of all, thank you for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links and further information on this charrette.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you've enjoyed it, help us spread the word. Tell your friends, your charretters, everybody. Tell them to give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify, and tell them to write us a review. This will all help us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about these amazing ladies with us.
Your support means everything to us. If you've enjoyed our content and want other ways to help us with our mission, you can support us by visiting our website for merchandise.
If you don't need any more swag, but you'd still like to consider supporting the research we're doing, you can donate to us on our website, shebuildspodcast.com/donate, or you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/shebuildspodcast. You can also find links to all of these items on our website.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com, leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on X at shebuildspod. Until then, see you later.
Bye.
Bye.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects. You got anything? Yeah. I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season 1 featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, that then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like, long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges, demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
one that
God.
Came out of nowhere.
Woo!
It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.